BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. And, for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is Greg Jackson, the founder and CEO of Octopus Energy. In just 7 years, it has become the UK's second largest domestic energy provider with over 5 million customers and is one of Europe's leading investors in renewables. The company shook up the established energy market through innovative technology. Its operating system, the enjoyably named Kraken, is now used by suppliers, including many rivals, around the world and is estimated to be worth billions in its own right. But as well as being a CEO who understands the global market, he's one who knows how it feels to be scared to open your gas bill. He grew up in a single-parent family in Halifax, where money was tight and the supply was sometimes cut off after a final demand went unpaid. He was entrepreneurial from a young age. He tinkered with tech and became so successful as a bedroom coder that he left school at 16 to work for a games manufacturer. Later, he returned to education and studied economics at Cambridge, where he began honing his business strategy. He says, "I'm not going to tell everyone they should be an entrepreneur and go and do it, but what you shouldn't do is sit there wishing for a different life. Either do it or don't." Greg Jackson, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thanks for having me.
So, Greg, you are clearly someone with drive. Is it a powerful motivator for you today as much as it ever was?
Yeah, it is. I don't necessarily think drive is a good thing, by the way. It enables you to do a lot, but I think it also means you're often very restless, and certainly for me, it means I'm not very good at relaxing, not great at watching movies, but I wouldn't change a thing.
How and where do your best ideas come to you, I wonder, Greg?
It's always when you're getting your hands dirty. So if I'm with some of our engineers, software engineers, and seeing what they're capable of and then realising how I can solve a problem elsewhere in the business. I think a lot of people in companies and other organisations will go away for an innovation session or sit there and try to think of ideas. But of course, you can't think of ideas on demand, not good ones. Last February, I was walking home, it was 10 o'clock, 10:30 at night, bitterly cold. And I knew that in the energy crisis, the early stages of it then, some of our customers will be scared to put their heating on. But I remembered a conversation I'd had with a PhD engineer who said, look, it only takes 40 watts to heat a human. And a gas boiler is 10,000 watts. So if we can get 40 watts into someone, we can keep them safe and warm. So I phoned up our chief product officer, and it's 10 o'clock at night, 10:30. And I said, look, can we get 5,000 electric blankets? And when someone's speaking to our team and they're worried about their health because they're worried about turning the heating on, send them one. We didn't announce it. The last thing I wanted was kind of people saying, look, an energy company says you can't turn heating on. But actually,
It came out on social media.
It did. After a few months, some of the customers were so happy. They posted it on social media. And I think we ended up giving away 40,000 electric blankets to help people. Our customers really matter to us. And having custodianship for that, rather than just selling electricity and gas, I think that's kind of such a source of the innovation.
Right. It's time to get stuck into your first disc, Greg Jackson. What are we going to hear?
When I was about 16, we'd just finished GCSEs. And with three mates, we went camping across North Yorkshire. We had very little money and tents on our backs and cans of beans in the bags. And we had a little radio, a little FM radio that could pick up two radio stations. Almost all the time, at least one of them was playing Yaz and the Plastic Population, The Only Way Is Up. There are 4 16-year-olds who don't really know what camping gear is, yomping across, I don't know, places like Osmotherley and Pickering through very peaceful countryside with that blaring out of the tinniest radio you've ever seen.
The Only Way Is Up, Yaz and the Plastic Population. So, Greg, I want to go back to the beginning. Your dad, Brian, was a surveyor in the army, and you were born on a base near Hanover, Germany, 1971. What do you remember about your early years there?
My first language was German. I think my mum at the time was very keen that we integrate. So
did you didn't live on the base then?
No, I think she actually had us live in the town, and she spoke fluent German, and it was my first language. I still remember being chased around the house with mum shouting, you know, "Raus, raus, schnell, schnell." So, you know, there was that sort of early exposure. But sadly, I've lost all my German now.
So your mum and dad both came from Halifax?
Yeah, look, I mean, they were both super bright people, but because of the social structure at the time, they both left school at 16. I think they both had A's at O level, something like that.
So they should have gone on to university, but didn't have the opportunity.
It would be more likely today that would be what happened. And so I think they were quite cosmopolitan, but came back to the UK when I was about 3 years old. So it was a very brief period of my life.
Your dad left the army and the family came back to Halifax. How did they adjust to being back in the UK?
Dad found a job in construction, working on surveying road building projects. I mean, typically those projects are wherever they are. And so we didn't see him much.
And it wasn't long after they came back that your mum and dad told you that they were going to get a divorce. Do you remember the moment they told you?
Yeah, I do. I was 7-ish years old. And they sat me on the washing machine, which is kind of the zero eye level, I guess, with parents. And told me, that dad would be leaving. And I remember it really hit me. I think it's about that age when a boy sometimes transfers his closest parental imprint from mother to father. And I think it was around that time. So for me personally, it hit me hard.
I can see that you feel the emotion of it now, looking back.
Not long afterwards, mum took me to a sort of child psychologist or therapist, I don't know what you call it these days, provided by a local council. And it was transformative, actually. One or two sessions made a world of difference and probably gave me the confidence and everything that has helped me be who I am. And I'm really grateful for that.
I think we better have some more music, Greg. Your second choice today. What have you gone for and why?
This is one of the first records I ever bought. There was a small record shop in Halifax and we used to get the bus home from school so I could drop by and flick through. At the time, I had a babysitter whose boyfriend had a motorbike and they were both into heavy metal. And so I had this kind of early indoctrination. The song is Run to the Hills by Iron Maiden.
Classic.
Laden with meaning and also with the most powerful, optimistic driving guitars. Run to the hills. Run for your lives. Run to the hills. Run for your lives. Soldier blue in the barren waste, hunting and killings again, raping the women.
Iron Maiden and Run to the Hills. Greg Jackson, did life change for you after your dad left the family home?
I don't think I noticed it in that way. It was interesting when I was at school once and someone told me about their dad telling them off. I was like, what, your dad tells you off? It didn't feel like it didn't feel like something I missed. And then mum was incredible, you know. I think when they first got divorced, she had no job. She started working in a pub in the evening. She studied by day to get a degree. She had three kids, you know. I was about 8, my sister about 7, and my youngest brother was a baby. I think she's about 4'8". She'd get on the bus to go into central Halifax, come back carrying all the week's shopping and carrier bags. We had so much freedom. Mum's way of making it all work was to devolve responsibility and freedom to us as kids. I was probably about 10 or 11 years old when she said, right, there's a thing called family allowance. I get a few quid off the government every week. I'm supposed to spend it on clothes and food for you. So from now on, I'm going to give it straight to you and you can buy your own clothes and things like that. Having that freedom early, and for example, I chose not to buy clothes. I bought little bits of electronics and tinkered. So I think I truly relished the freedom and the creativity that we had as kids.
How did she manage all of those financial, emotional pressures that she must have been under? And were you aware of how much she was dealing with? You paint a picture of her on the bus with a week's shopping at not even 5 foot tall and three kids. I mean, you can see it.
She was really emotionally open. But I mean, most of the time she wasn't struggling. She was working. I mean, not only did she do a part-time job and study and bring up three kids, and anyone's bringing up kids as part of a couple knows how hard it is, never mind doing it on their own, never mind in that situation. But she also spent, you know, her spare time, I don't know where that came from, campaigning, you know, for the stuff she believed in. She helped set up women's refuges. she was part of the CND movement. She used to go on marches. And she packed it all in. The inspiration there, in terms of being able to pack so much in and be fully human and work so hard on the things you care about, on the things you need to put around the table for the people you love. Yeah, I think that's inspirational.
Your mum found it difficult to pay the bills often. Was that something that, you were aware of? You said she was very open with you all.
Yeah, I remember her schooling me in, because I'd say, "Mum, there's a final demand," and she said, "Ah, but it's not in red." So she knew kind of the order the different bills would come before you got to the one that meant you're on file.
You've really got to start doing something about this now.
Yeah, and even then...
Even opening the envelope.
That's right. And even then, you know, back then, people would send a cheque and say, you know, how many days you could post-date a cheque.
And you did have services cut off to the house.
Yeah, back then, a guy would turn up with a wrench, I mean, for the gas. Yeah, I remember that very well.
It's time for your next disc, Greg. Your third choice today. What are we going to hear and why?
We were a Radio 4 house. It was on all the time. Mum listened to it from the moment she woke up to long after she went to sleep. And there's nothing more Radio 4 than the shipping forecast. I think when I was about 14, after she'd gone to bed on Christmas Eve, I started drilling holes and laying wires around the house and putting speakers in multiple rooms so that she could listen to Radio 4 everywhere in the house. And she woke up on Christmas Day and I think she liked it.
Dogger Fisher, easterly, 5 or 6, increasing gale 8 in Dogger, and perhaps later in Fisher. Wintry showers, moderate or good. German Bight, Humber, Thames, Dover, White. East 6, increasing gale 8 at times, perhaps severe gale 9 later in White. Rain or sleet later, moderate or poor. Portland, Plymouth, east 7 to severe gale 9. Rain at times, moderate or poor.
An extract from the shipping forecast, read by Eugene Fraser, for your mother, Greg Jackson. I know you didn't see much of your father when you were growing up, but the two of you did reconnect later. How did it happen, and what's your relationship like today?
I think he's incredibly smart and funny, and he's a big fan of rugby league, of Halifax. And also, by the way, of Halifax Town Football Club. And both of them end up coming to Wembley sometimes. And because I live in London, he always comes and stays. And it's so nice to have him there and share his passion for blue and white. My dad and I look the same. Like, if you look at a photo of my dad when he was young, he looked like me. I therefore know what I'm going to look like when I'm older. It kind of gets you by the heart.
So at school, you did well in your exams, but you decided to leave at 16 as soon as you'd finished your O-levels. Why did you want to do that, and how did your mum react?
I think the kind of freedom and responsibility mum had given us meant that there wasn't really any discussion. And there wasn't really, I don't remember any expectations that I was trying to fulfil by staying in education. I was with that generation of bedroom programmers that learnt to code on a Sinclair Spectrum, and you could feel that was a moment in time, and that really appealed. So I think it started probably a bit younger than that. I mean, I remember about the age of 7 or 8, getting those electronics kits that you get for kids. I got one for Christmas, I think, where you make lights and buzzers and things. And I remember probably about that age, actually, taking the wall clock off the wall and then wiring it into a tape recorder to create a music alarm clock. And now it was 240 volts, and that was when I got my first bad shock. So I was learning that stuff quite early. And when we moved to Saltburn, there was an electronics shop there with this lovely guy that ran it. I used to go in and say, "Look, can I buy a couple of transistors and some capacitors and resistors or whatever?" And he'd start talking to me about more advanced circuits and how different microchips would work and point me at books that I could learn from. And it was always that joy of building and solving problems.
So you left school and then became a freelance coder for video games. Your first game didn't go down too well, though. Why not?
If you looked at the software, you go, "That is elegant, great code."
The coding was lovely.
Yeah, but the game was not fun to play. And
so what was it called?
It was Professional Wrestling Simulator. And the people I was writing it for said, "We're not going to publish it." And I was gutted. I suddenly realised I'd done months of work. I was not going to get paid anything. And I think what that taught me was this incredible lesson that it doesn't matter how good you think your work is. What matters is it what customers want? And what I created there was something customers wouldn't want. Because the ultimate thing of a game is got to be fun to play. Doesn't matter what the coding is. And I think that lesson stuck with me. So I've run technology businesses since then. I'm always thinking about, like, what is it we're doing for customers rather than what is it we're doing for ourselves.
So by this point in life, I think your mum had got a job as a sociology lecturer at a further education college in Redcar and moved the family to Saltburn, which is nearby. You stayed in Halifax, though. Where were you living?
My grandparents had gone travelling, so I stayed in their house.
And, so you were rattling around in there at 16. That's quite a big responsibility, isn't it, for a 16-year-old, looking after yourself?
Yeah, I just didn't see it like that. It felt perfectly normal. And, you know, I could cook very basic meals. I truly loved the freedom.
Time for some more music, Greg. Your fourth choice today. What's next and why?
While I was living in West Yorkshire and doing the video games, U2 played a concert at Roundhay Park. And I'd never been to a big music event before. U2 were this tiny dot in the distance, but the music was so powerful. U2 is something that it's something I turn to when I play too much heavy metal. And it's hard choosing the track, but I still haven't found what I'm looking for. Maybe it resonates a bit with me. It's that desire to keep on making things better.
And I still haven't found what I'm looking for. So, Greg Jackson, when you were 17, you decided to return to education and take your A-levels at a local college. You then got a place at Cambridge University to read economics. What made you decide to go back to school?
After discovering that it was possible to spend several months working and not get paid for it, I thought, I want to make sure I've got fallback plans. And I did an economics A-level and I just fell in love with the subject. It's not about money. It's about people and resources. I found it absolutely inspiring because our entire lives are governed by, you know, do we have access to the resources we need or that we want? And how do we make more of those resources without trashing the natural resource of the planet?
So off you went to Cambridge to study economics. And it was there that you met James Edison, who now works alongside you at Octopus. The two of you developed your first tech project together. What was it?
James and I were on the sort of student council, the version of a student union there. We organised events and we organised one very big event. And we decided to use technology to the security. We did infrared barcodes back in 1992.
And so this was like a club night then, or a ball or something?
Yeah,
what kind of event was it?
A bit of everything. Okay. You know, we had live bands, we had hypnotists, we had people dressing up in sumo suits. We had Velcro, you know, barfly jumping where you put Velcro on the wall and spring into it. Starts at 6 p.m, ends at 6 a.m. It was kind of our first tech project. It was also our first kind of business venture.
After university, you joined Procter & Gamble's graduate scheme, working in marketing, but you left there after 4 years. Why didn't you want to stay?
I could feel that I was getting more and more tempted to stay on a corporate conveyor belt. And life would be comfortable and easy, but I wanted to make more decisions. I wanted stuff that I did to matter, not to feel like a small cog in a massive machine. And so I just had to leave.
You got a job as a commercial director for a company called Richmond Mirrors, which, funnily enough, made mirrors. And after a couple of months, the owners promoted you to managing director, and that was your chance to run something. I think you're about 27 then, so pretty young to be given that responsibility. Can you remember how it felt?
When I took it on, I don't know, we had 60 or 70 staff and £500,000 overdraft and £500,000 overdraft limit. And every month, to begin with, was just about making sure that we could look after the team financially, and then find what was it that would break us through. So we had a couple of products in the Argos catalogue, and they sold okay.
So these are mirrors?
Mirrors, yeah. But I opened the catalogue and noticed that, of course, when you look at a picture of a mirror, you can't see the frame because it's tiny. What you see is just all the mirrors look the same. So we designed a mirror with really fat frames, which meant in the Argos catalogue you could see the design. And it sold like hotcakes. Kind of that small detail, in a way, transformed the business. And I remember I used to go to pies and everyone there would be a lawyer and a management consultant. I was like, I manufacture mirrors. But I loved it. I loved the autonomy, the freedom and the creativity we had. It's real. You know, you could go into the factory floor, operate the machines, talk to the team. I learned to drive a forklift truck. It was fantastic.
I think we better have some more music, Greg. This is your fifth choice today. What's it going to be? What are you taking to the island next and why?
When I was at university, we were organising these events. We had attractions like the Velcro suits, but also fantastic music that would get everyone up and dancing. And I remember time and again dancing to Dizzy by Vic Reeves and the Wonder Stuff. It was just such a fun time. All of your mates sweating as we bounce around.
Vic Reeves and the Wonder Stuff with Dizzy. Greg Jackson, the Mirror Company was sold in the year 2000 and you walked away back then with a six-figure sum. Then in 2003, you co-founded a tech business that built software and databases for clients. Now, by 2011, you were looking for a new challenge and you found one in the form of the energy market. Why energy specifically?
Energy stood out, you know. Globally, it's a $2 trillion sector and yet it was running on software that's two or three decades old. And when I thought about it, it's like, hang on, that's why service is so bad, because you have computers says no because someone's sitting in front of six different systems trying to help a customer. And you've got brilliant people held back by technology. And then we paid too much for it. Back then, you know, there were a lot of stories about energy costs, which, of course, are dwarfed by the current crisis. But you could see that the route to cutting costs was going to be innovation.
It must have had a personal connection for you as well, you know, having grown up in a house where the relationship with basic service providers was stressful and fraught and a little bit unpredictable.
I just remember that cutting off moment and the phenomenal stress of final demands. I think really understanding the extent to which, if you're selling watches, it's fine to try and make expensive products. But if you're selling something everyone needs, like energy, we've got a moral sort of imperative to try and drive the cost down. And that we could see that technology could do that.
But I think it was a night in the pub that really clinched it for you. Tell me about it. What happened?
I'd moved house and finally got round to opening an energy bill. And it was eye-watering. And I phoned up the energy company and they said, oh, we'll cut that for you. I was like, what? Is that easy? And they said, yeah, you weren't on a contract because you just moved in. And then sometime later, maybe a couple of years later, I remember looking at the bills again and going, hang on, this is eye-watering. And I phoned them up and they said, oh, we'll cut that for you. And I was like, no, no, you've already done that. And they said, no, no, the contract expired. So you went on to the default rate. And I was like, what? So I have to phone you up every year to get a decent price. And that felt so wrong. And I was complaining to my mates about that. And I said, I should set up an energy company. And they were like, you'll never do that. And I thought, well, maybe we will.
So in the early days, how easy was it for you to win customers? You know, it's one thing you having a sense of belief in what you're doing, but how did you persuade them?
We had to talk to customers almost one-to-one to begin with, and in social media and by email and everywhere we could find them. We were winning one customer at a time. It's like hand-to-hand combat. And I mean, to begin with, we had a little bell in the office every time we won a customer. There'd be a pinging sound off. It was a computer bell. I cobbled that together myself with my remnants of technology skills.
And how ambitious were you back then? I mean, if I'd looked at that first business plan that you created, would I have seen a sense of the scale that you've already achieved?
The first draft did have that scale in. I've got to say, we thought, like, no one's going to believe this is possible. So we kind of massaged it down. The numbers were so big, we thought, this is what we want to build, what we think we can build. Mm-hmm. But we just didn't know whether investors would believe us. So,
it look more realistic.
Well, less ambitious. But the reality is we've delivered, you know, the ambition and more. I never know whether the answer for this is that we should be braver in declaring our ambitions. Maybe we should.
It's time for some more music, Greg. What's next?
There's a beautiful song by Kenny Rogers. It's The Gambler. There's a bit that says, never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done. It's not really about money. It's really about, while we're living our lives, we can't declare success or failure. That all comes at the end.
Is that a motto that you live by?
Yeah, it is. And when people say, look, you've been successful, it's like, I don't know whether we have yet. We've had lots of successes, but a bit like, you know, The Gambler. During the game of poker, they'll play many hands, they'll win some and they'll lose some. They don't know till the game's over. And I think, yeah, we've got to be humble all the time and recognise that we've got to just keep on working unbelievably hard rather than at any point getting comfortable.
And his face lost all expression. Said if you're going to play the game, boy, you got to learn to play it right. You got to know when to hold up,
Know when to fold up, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your money. When you're sitting at the table, there'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done.
Kenny Rogers and the Gambler. Greg Jackson, when you started the business, you were taking on a sector that had been dominated by what were then called the Big Six energy firms, and you became known as something of a disruptor. How do you feel about that term? You're wincing.
I don't like the term, but really it's that challenge. It says, look, energy's been a sector for 100, 150 years. Most of the way that it's been thought about has not really changed dramatically in that time. And yet, by the way, the energy sector is going to change more over the next 10 or 15 years than over the last 100, because we've got to increasingly use renewable energy rather than fossil fuels. Cars will go electric not because of legislation, but because electric cars are better and they're just going to keep getting cheaper. Heating will go electric because it's going to keep getting cheaper and will get better. All of that is change that we can bring. Now, is that disruption? I don't know, but it's improvement. It's an upgrade.
Last year, you took over Bulb Energy, which had collapsed as a result of the energy crisis, and you're in the process of buying Shell's household energy business in the UK and in Germany. Isn't there a danger that Octopus Energy will get too big and that the customer service you pride yourself on will start to suffer?
Actually, I think it's easier to provide better services as we get bigger, because if you take a problem that only one customer had when we were small, we might have 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 with it. So we can create better solutions in the technology to remove those problems. We can learn more and we can reapply learnings across the world.
And of course, you've been growing the business alongside bringing up your family. You've got two boys. Lucas is 16, I think, and Zach is 6. And you don't live with their mum, but they do stay with you a couple of nights a week and on alternate weekends. How do you juggle the competing demands of work and family? I mean, you're running an international business now.
Travel means that it's much harder now than actually it was even just working hard before. And so because of this, the importance of particularly the Wednesday night with the boys, I've done things like flying to Japan on a Sunday night. I get to Tokyo Monday morning, meetings there, meetings in Yokohama Monday afternoon, dinner in Tokyo Monday evening, and then plane overnight to Sydney, meetings in Sydney on Tuesday morning, and then to Melbourne, meetings in Melbourne Tuesday evening, then back on a plane to get to the UK in time for school pickup on a Wednesday. And that sort of thing is quite hard. I talk to the boys about it. I say, look, I try to be present, but if something happens, then and I take a phone call, that phone is what enables me to be here, and I'll get rid of it as quick as I can. I also try and I'm not massively into cooking. I'm not a very good cook, but I think for the boys, it kind of shows love. I was cooking spaghetti and fish fingers. I mean, a quality meal. trying to juggle stuff for the boys.
Italian classic. Yeah.
Getting a phone call, cradling the phone because my headset had fallen out. And then Zach was climbing up the cupboards and had to try and prevent that. Cradling the phone and then dropping the spaghetti all over my feet and definitely trying to pack it all in. Leads to some fairly messy kitchens.
It's time for some more music. Greg Jackson, your seventh choice today. What's it going to be?
I've got this beautiful video of my two boys growing up. The soundtrack to it is One Day Like This by Elbow. And I can't watch it without welling up. And it's just all the fun times and happy times. And anyway.
This is for them.
Yeah. What made me behave that way? These are words I never say. Like a beautiful day.
Elbow and One Day Like This. Greg Jackson, Octopus Energy has yet to make a profit. Why not exactly?
We're in the very early stages of building a global business, and you know, we've only really just started. I'm incredibly proud of what we've achieved if you look down the mountain, but if we look up, we've got so much further to go.
Yeah, I think you've actually said we could have made a profit, but now's not the time.
As we went into the energy crisis, we didn't know how long it was going to last and how deep it was going to get. And we're still
in it.
We're still in the crisis, right? And I think the world is more prepared for it now, but we just had to put everything we had into helping with that.
You gave up your salary.
Yeah. But things like, you know, the reason I gave up my salary and went to minimum wage was to be able to put money into looking after our staff and customers, myself.
You own a 6% stake in the company worth many millions. How important is money to you personally?
It's easy to say it's not about the money. For people who've got no money at all, money's really important. I think I know that person from childhood. You know, for me, all my money's tied up in the company. If the company's successful, then I'm very well off.
And how do you answer those who think that this is all very shrewd PR? I mean, however laudable your intentions, your company is primarily concerned with making money.
Yeah, look, I mean, first of all, I'm not ashamed that we will have to make money. After all, investors have put an awful lot of money in. But, you know, the real challenge is the system needs completely overhauling. And if we can use the investment we've received in conversations like this to talk about a cheaper system, then there's room to slash prices and, you know, for companies to make a little bit of profit.
Are you optimistic about what the future holds?
I'm really optimistic about energy. I know that all the solutions are there for a cheaper, cleaner energy system. The combination of wind and solar, electric cars, long-distance cables connecting continents so we can ship electricity from where it's sunny to where it's not and from where it's windy. The UK could be a clean energy powerhouse because it's windy here a lot. We've got fantastic wind. We don't need to be at the mercy of a global fossil fuel sector.
You've got a new challenge ahead, Greg. You're off to the desert island in a minute. How will you approach life there?
People pay a fortune to go on sunny beach holidays.
True.
And I've got one to myself. That's amazing. So first of all, I'm going to make sure I enjoy it. But I'll be restless. So I'm going to want to spend as much of the time as I can doing two things. I think one is trying to build stuff to make the island ever more enjoyable. Maybe build a surfboard. Like, let's make the most of the thing, right? But also try to build stuff to leave the island. Because although I'm going to love it, I've got to try, because I can't
always
go back.
So you're going to attempt escape quite early then?
Yeah, I don't want to call it escape because, you know, I want to make sure I'm making the most of this. But I would love the opportunity to explore other places too. But, you know, I might quite like this, so I might want to come back as well.
Okay, you just want the option.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, one more track before we send you to your island. Final choice today. What's it going to be?
It's Rockaway Beach by Motorhead, right?
And so this is covering Ramones.
Yeah, it's covering Ramones. And Lemmy's gravelly voice is so human. This is a song about enjoying yourself on the beach. And whilst I'm working on making the beach better and indeed perhaps finding ways to explore, I'm going to have this banging.
Sun is out and I want some. It's not hard, no fun to reach. Bringing it your own to Rockaway Beach. Up on the roof, out on the street. Down in the playground, the hard concrete. First ride, it's radio slow. Blast at the rhythm on the radio. Rock, rock, Rockaway Beach. Rock, rock, Rockaway Beach. Rock, rock, Rockaway Beach.
Motorhead's cover of Ramones' Rockaway Beach. Final track for you then, Greg Jackson. It is time to send you away to the island. I'm giving you the books to take with you, the Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare. You can take another book of your choice. What are you going to go for?
I'm going to take a book called The Apollo Guidance Computer Manual. It's been by the side of my bed on and off for years now. And I turn to it and just randomly open pages. Now, it's basically about the computers that formed the guidance system that took men to the moon in 1969. But the reality is, it's a story of unbelievable human ingenuity.
It's yours. You can also have a luxury item to make life more enjoyable or for sensory stimulation on the island. What have you gone for?
I'm going to take a pinball machine. It's this combination of the physics and the electronics. And actually, pinball's got quite deep gameplay with a storyline. And so the one I want to take is one called Monster Bash. And it's a whole series of fantastic rocky tracks that you unlock by achieving certain goals with the pinballs. It's going to be solar powered and it's going to be on full volume because there's no one there to complain.
Monster Bash it is. It's yours. And finally, which one track of the eight that you've shared with us today would you save from the waves first?
One Day Like This. Because every time I listen to it, I'll be picturing the boys.
Greg Jackson, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you, Laura.
Hello, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Greg. We'll leave him playing very loud pinball on the beach, I think. We've cast away many people from the business world, including Tom Ilube, Deborah Meaden, Joe Fairley and John Cordwell. You can find these episodes in our Desert Island Discs programme archive and through BBC Sounds. The studio manager for today's programme was Sue Mayo and the producer was Paula McGinley. Next time, my guest will be the film studio executive, Dame Donna Langley. I do hope you'll join us.
Hi, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox.
And we want to tell you about a great series we've made for BBC Radio 4.
Let's just say it's average.
It's above average. Each one is a handy little guide to everything from the supernatural to the meaning of infinity. The
supernatural one will be short because there's no such thing.
I am so going to haunt you for saying that. We've pulled the best moments from the past 27 series of the show. That's nearly 15 years worth to bring you some of the most surprising science and sometimes, hopefully in your judgment, some of the funniest moments with guests including
Steve Martin, Brian Blessed, Josie Long.
And some scientists, lots of scientists as well. Listen now on BBC Sounds.